Good afternoon. My name is Doug Schmidt, and I'm a professor in the computer science department. And I'll be taking the next hour or so to talk about the world is flat and what you can do about it. Since I'm a computer science professor and not a geology or geography professor, the flat world I'll be talking about here will not be the concept that you'll fall off the earth if you go too far, but more that the playing field is being leveled due to effects of what's called globalization, which are having a major impact on the way in which our students and other professionals in the United States work with technologies and how we compete in the broader world. This talk basically deals with the whole issue of globalization. When I went to graduate school in the mid to late 80s, that was the time when the US IT economy worried that Japan was going to take over the country. Remember, they were buying Rockefeller Plaza and all the golf courses in California and so on. And there was a lot of deep concern that we were going to have a hard time competing. And I'll never forget, one of my grad student buddies walked in one day and he said he just started working for the company Canon. And he said, remember that famous quote from King Charles V of Spain who said, "I speak Spanish to my God, Italian to women, French to men, and German to my horse." He said, "I have a new phrase, and Japanese to my boss." And that was my first exposure to globalization. If you read the book The World is Flat by Thomas Friedman, who's a very interesting pundit and observer of global technology trends, he identifies three basic epochs in globalization. The first was between 1492 and the 1800s, when what was important were countries, nation states, and their military muscle. So, of course, people like Napoleon would be a classic example of someone who thrived in that period of globalization, basically colonialists. From the 1800s to around the turn of the millennia, the focus of globalization was on multinational companies. Here's a picture of me. It's kind of hard to see at the resolution. I'm standing in front of a Starbucks coffee shop in the Insadong region of Seoul, Korea. And in that particular place, they don't let them use the Starbucks logo, it has to be in Korea, in Korean, but yet they still have a Starbucks there in the traditional part of the city. The major focus of the book, and really of the talk, is what he calls Globalization 3.0, the third version, the third release of globalization. And what the book talks about is this really is focusing on the ability of individuals and groups to collaborate and compete with each other in new and more effective ways. And I thought to myself, what is perhaps the most visceral notion or consequence of globalization, which was the erosion of U.S. basketball power, and how today we're even lucky to get medals in international competitions. So clearly the competition and the playing field has been very profoundly leveled. Now, obviously, there are more interesting ways in which that's happening as well. So in his book, and in the first two-thirds of the talk, I'm going to give you a quick summary of what Friedman believed were the 10 flatteners that are changing the world, making the world a flat world, leveling the playing field. There's some really interesting reviews, by the way, of the book. If you go onto the Amazon website, they have many interesting observations from people, both pro and con, about whether what he says is in fact true. But irrespective of whether it's true or not, it's interesting and provocative and makes a good respite from standing outside in the hot sun on the graduation days. The first flattener he talks about is what he refers to as 11/9/89, which of course was the day that the Berlin Wall fell. And at least in those days, I don't know if you recall this, that was when we had the peace dividend and we could cut our forces and going to be peace for our time yet again. And of course what happened there was, for a whole variety of different reasons, many of the people living in the so-called Warsaw Pact and in the Soviet bloc were no longer being held down by the authoritarian regimes. And this, of course, also had a lot of spin-off effects of countries that were kind of in between or in the orbit of some of those other regimes. In some sense, and keep in mind this book by Friedman was written about 4 years ago or so some of this stuff is changing underfoot, but basically his point is that the 11989 tipped the balance from authoritarianism to free markets. I think that the jury is still out as to whether that's actually happened or whether the free markets have become, that the authoritarian regimes have become more clever economically while still remaining largely authoritarian in many ways. But be that as it may, one of the consequences that has occurred because of the globalization and increased competition and the unleashing of many, many very smart people who heretofore had been bottled up in behind the walls, literally, both virtually and physically, is the fact that we had a lot more talent in the IT world. And those people were able to create products and services that commoditized many of the technologies that we now take for granted, which of course is why computers are faster and cheaper and better every couple of years, because we're having so many smart people work on that kind of stuff. Just as a kind of an interesting corollary, another consequence of the 11-9 phenomena was creating the mutant supply chains, as Friedman calls them, that to some extent gave rise to 9-11, because a lot of the forces that had been busy fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan were then free to turn their attention elsewhere. I won't go into that in much detail, but it's just kind of interesting to see how what we thought was a change in one dimension really affected us in other ways we hadn't expected at the time. Moving ahead about 6 years, in about the middle of 1995, and I remember this very well because I had just graduated from college, from grad school, and was a professor at Washington University. And this is when Netscape went public. And as you recall, that was the start of Gold Rush fever. Many of you probably put a lot of money into companies like that and wonder what happened to them come 2001, 2002. Whenever you have gold rushes, there's always the consequence of ghost towns. They seem to go hand in hand. And that's certainly what happened. But some other interesting things happened along the way that are still playing out in various ways. One of the most interesting things that Netscape did is it allowed us to be able to access resources in the internet in a way that was accessible to more than just technologists. Before that point, people had to know very obscure and convoluted interfaces for accessing content that was available in the internet. But the Netscape browser and all the browsers that came after that really made a tipping point or a phase transition in the accessibility of information. And that, of course, has led to all kinds of wonderful things and maybe not so many wonderful things. It's led to electronic commerce, which makes it easier to shop for stuff and get good prices. It's also led to internet addiction and email addiction. It's also led to spam and all the other things, and phishing attacks and so on. Combined with the Telecom Communication Act of 1996, which allowed a lot more different industries to compete with each other for communications, these events led to a tremendous growth in the laying of fiber optic cable. And even though that didn't necessarily turn out the way we expected either, it provided the foundation, literally, for some other flatteners we're about to talk about shortly. And it's kind of interesting in a James Burke connection-esque way to kind of see how different things came along and they had unintended consequences that led us in directions we're still seeing playing out today. An interesting question that Friedman raises in his book, and it's kind of at the heart of this issue of globalization, is who will be the next Netscape and where will they be based? Now, I think there probably is an answer to that. I think the next Netscape turned out to be Google. So the question, of course, is who will be the next Google and where will they be based? And the point Friedman's trying to make, and I think the one that we all have to keep aware of, is the fact that those places may or may not necessarily be based in the US in the future. In fact, there's a great quote by Bill Gates from a couple years ago who said, "Today, I would rather be a bright person in China than an average person in Poughkeepsie." Now, not taking anything away from Poughkeepsie, but the point there is that 20 years ago, you'd rather be that average person in Poughkeepsie, because the person who was bright in China probably had very little chance for advancement, and their chance for advancement probably ended up coming down to going to the United States for graduate school. But those things are changing, and we have to keep in mind that our head start in these areas is not necessarily a God-given right that we'll have forever. Another interesting thing he talks about in the book is something called workflow software, and this gets a little esoteric, so I won't spend a whole lot of time on it, but it's basically the way in which businesses talk to businesses. Most of our personal experience with Netscape and the internet and the World Wide Web probably comes from sitting in front of our PCs or laptops engaged in e-commerce or browsing CNN or other kinds of interactions. But there's a lot of other technologies taking place under the hood, for example, between various parts of the banking sector, between various parts of manufacturing and retail stores and so on. And this is all about trying to make information flow to make commerce more seamless. There's all kinds of wonderful, obscure, 3- and 4-letter acronyms that give rise to all this stuff in the form of protocols, and I won't spend a lot of time on the technical details there. What I will mention, though, is the consequence of the workflow software boom is that we're starting to get the same kind of productivity boosts in the service sector that things like the assembly line ended up doing for manufacturing back 80 to 90 years ago. And so you're starting to see information and commerce conducted at a much, much faster rate, which is having all kinds of interesting effects. The next topic, which is something that, again, is perhaps a little techy and a little geeky, but something I've been working on for a long time, is the concept of open source software. Historically, when people built software, for example, when Microsoft built software, they'll ship you application binary code that you can use on your PC or laptop, but they keep the source code, the crown jewels, hidden away behind a firewall, and only a selected few set of people can actually work on it. Open source is really about trying to move the development and debugging and other software lifecycle expertise out of the core group into the periphery, into the user community. And there's several reasons for this. One reason for this is that software development doesn't scale up very well. If you have 1,000 people trying to build a piece of software versus 10 people, chances are the 10 people might do a better job. So it's hard to scale up development. In contrast, trying to improve the quality of software is something that does scale. If you have 1,000 people trying to test software versus 10 people testing software, those 1,000 people will find a lot more defects. And so that's what really open source is about. It's about moving the onus of development and debugging from the core out to the periphery, where there's many, many more resources available. Open source is kind of like dark fiber. It enables other flatteners. It allows a lot more people to be involved in the software development process. It allows people from other countries who could never be hired or come to the U.S., especially now we have so many quotas on H-1B visas, to be involved in building software and improving it. We, in our work at Vanderbilt, get a lot of involvement and a lot of benefit from working with people literally from around the world, taking the open source software that we develop and improving it in all kinds of different ways. And it also helps to accelerate technology transfer, because people can try out the software very inexpensively, and once they discover they like it, then they may be willing to pay for service contracts and other forms of support in order to be able to use it. Again, this is a bit of an aside, but open source is becoming crucially important in the academic world because it provides a way for other scholars and researchers to learn from and build upon the benefits of your research. In fact, in some parts of the world, and particularly in Europe, major programs, air traffic management, space programs, the Galileo global positioning system, for example, the CoFlight air traffic management system, this is the European air traffic system, those systems are now mandated to be based on open source technologies because it gives them a better ability to get people to be involved with this without locking them into one particular solution from one particular vendor in one particular place. Perhaps a more interesting topic, and certainly one if you think back about 8 or 9 years ago, is the topic of outsourcing. And I don't know if you remember the fear and trepidation that gripped the land around 1998 to 2000 when even very smart, respected people like Leonard Nimoy were worried about the end of the world and went and lived inside a bunker someplace in Cheyenne Mountain because they were worried about what was going to happen when the clocks struck midnight on 2000. One of the consequences of this was that the U.S. companies, especially the big insurance and banking industries and healthcare industries, had way too much work doing replacing the 2-digit dates with 4-digit dates. And so as a result, they outsourced a lot of that work to India, where there were people available who were smart and inexpensive and could help them with that conversion process. Friedman refers to this as the second buyer irony. For years, the United States has been the beneficiary of second buyers of India's education system. The IIT, the India Institute of Technology, the universities there, are one of the few things in that country that are based entirely, or mostly entirely, on merit. You simply can't buy or bribe your way into them. And even though they only produce about 24,000, 25,000 people a year, these are some of the smartest people you're ever going to meet. Very, very intelligent. And for years, until the last couple years, in fact, most of them came to the United States went to grad school and stayed here and worked in the IT field. And that was the second buyer irony. The Indian taxes paid for these smart people to go to school in India, and then we got the benefits of their training and education, and we got that without having to pay for it. Ironically, when the Y2K hit and people were building up the dot-com revolution, we laid a lot of dark fiber, and when all the bottom fell out, what was left was a lot of fiber, way too much fiber, because people didn't actually increase their use of the internet the way that people like Bernie Evers at WorldCom thought they were. And as a result, there was way too much fiber, and we, the U.S. taxpayer and investor, had paid for this, and India then bought it back for pennies on the dollar and used that to enable outsourcing, because they could sit in Bangalore and Hyderabad and so on and be able to do communication and work with people in the United States without having to pay very much for that infrastructure. When the dot-com bubble finally burst, the revenue disappeared and the shareholder value disappeared, but the need for supporting the customers didn't. And so as a result, there was still way too much work to be done. And so as a result, outsourcing became economically essential. I'll never forget, we do open source software here, and for years leading up to the burst of the dot-coms, a lot of the major companies, Lucent and IBM and Ericsson and so on, they were very disdainful. They said, we would never use this open source stuff. Why would we do this? We're better than that. We can build stuff in-house. It's better quality and so on. When the dot-com bubble hit, they had no revenue, and you would be amazed at how fast they fell all over themselves to find low-cost open source solutions to go in and keep the lights on while they laid off most of their workforce. Consequence, of course, was they discovered it actually worked pretty well, and as the revenue started to come back, they stuck with those solutions because they did work. I believe in the future, outsourcing will continue to be done not just because of cost. In fact, there's some very interesting ironies in India right now. Some of my graduate students have gone back there and worked for various companies, and one of them was complaining to me the other day. He said, you know, it's really just like what happened during the dot-com buildup in the late 90s. The students who go to the Indian universities know they're going to get good, high-paying jobs, relatively speaking, whether or not they study or do well in school. And so as a result, like students many places, they decided they'll take it easy, and so they don't work very hard. And I think in some sense that is perhaps our greatest hope, that students in other parts of the world will become as lazy and slothful as we are. Just kidding. But I think what's happening is over time these people are getting much better at what they do, and they're very smart. So as a result, people will make these choices not just because it's cheap, but because it's very good quality. In fact, this is a big fear of mine. We'll talk more about this later. If outsourcing is India, offshoring is China. And it's really about moving manufacturing of things, hardware, goods, cars, and so on, to low-cost labor markets. This is obviously a trend that's been going on for a long time. But it's only been in the last decade or so that the infrastructure, especially the information technology infrastructure and the supply chain infrastructure, has enabled this to take place at such a rapid pace. Obviously, there's lots of other things that are moving this forward as well, like global commerce and so on. This is a very controversial topic, and I think it's a very subtle and interesting topic with pros and cons on both sides. To some extent, we benefit from offshoring in some ways because we can go down to Walmart or Lowe's or Target and so on and get a lot of consumer-oriented goods relatively cheaply because they're manufactured overseas at less cost. And that's good, and it's potentially one reason why the inflation rate has remained relatively low over the last decade. On the other hand, there are downsides to that. When you start having other parts of the world manufacturing lots of things, they start to consume a lot of energy. And that increase in demand drives up the price. I put this talk together, and I got this slide, this picture, maybe about a year ago. Isn't it funny to see regular gasoline at $2.33 a gallon, thinking that's expensive, right? If only it was $2.33 a gallon. So there's trade-offs. There's also trade-offs. You've probably heard a lot of the controversy about Walmart, where a lot of their workers, because they don't really pay health insurance or haven't historically paid health insurance benefits, a lot of the people who work for Walmart have to go on welfare. And so as a result, you pay for the lower goods through your taxes or other costs on health care. So it's really a subtle thing, and I'm not going to make a statement either way, but it's often more subtle than it appears at first glance. I think ultimately this will be or is becoming a political issue. You can only go so far in some of these areas before people really start to go, you know, okay, David Ricardo says that moving things to cheap markets is good for the global economy, but what about me? What about my community? Is this really good? And there are lots of subtle issues there. Another topic in the book is about supply chain. And again, Walmart is kind of the exemplar of this particular approach, trying to do operations research and get the whole supply chain management down to a very, very fine art. The point that Friedman makes in the book, and I think it's a good point to remember, is that the fewer natural resources that your country has or your company has, his point was that living in Bentonville, Arkansas is not necessarily by itself a resource-rich environment, so people had to really work hard to innovate. The point is that the less you have in many ways, the harder you may choose to work. And I saw that firsthand when I went last year to Seoul, South Korea. There's me on a subway. I call this my Lost in Translation picture. And I was just amazed at how modern the city was, how actually very charming the city was, and how hard the people worked. It was just amazing. And I see the same thing with my graduate students who come over from other countries. When you grow up in a world with dirt floors, you often tend to push yourself pretty hard to move up in life. I think it was George Bernard Shaw who once said, my father was a coal miner, so I could be a doctor, so my son could be a poet. And it's a little unclear how long that can continue, mind you, but that's the old way of looking at things. The key, at least in Friedman's world viewpoint, is that if you want to be successful, you've got to figure out a way to leverage technology. So in manufacturing, buying in bulk, cutting out the middleman, minimizing inventories, we'll talk more about that in a second, using various technologies to track goods like RFID tags and so on. These are all crucially important ways of being able to manage supply chains in a more nimble fashion. And that is certainly something that's quite fascinating to watch that unfold. A related aspect to this is something he calls insourcing, or what can the guy in the funny brown shorts do for you? And basically, if you take a look at UPS, UPS used to be sort of like FedEx or DHL. They're just delivering packages quickly and overnight and so on. And they've really changed their view of what their business is. Their current model, their slogan is, your world synchronized. And they're not just about delivering packages, they're really about synchronizing global supply chains for companies. So for example, what UPS is doing is it's taking over operations that used to be done by companies that ship their products. So for example, if you order shoes online from Nike, chances are those shoes won't come from Beaverton, Oregon, or wherever Nike has its or from someplace in China. They aren't going to ship it from China when you order the shoes. They're going to have them stored someplace in a big supply center, probably near an airport like Memphis or so on. And when the order comes in, they'll just have a big pile of boxes of shoes at the airport, and UPS actually does the management of the inventory. And they do various similar things for repairs on laptops. If you get your Toshiba laptop repaired, the UPS person will come pick your laptop up, and rather than send it back to Nagasaki, Japan, or wherever, they will take it to the center, which is again at an airport somewhere in the US, and they'll repair it there and then ship it back to you. So it really optimizes the transmission of goods and the flow of the goods. And what it also does, it lets smaller companies leverage the supply chain management assets that used to be only available to larger companies. So smaller companies can leverage these capabilities and get the same effect globally that used to require being an IBM or a Ford or a Boeing. It also, of course, changes who is your competitor and who is your partner. Because all of a sudden, if you're in the laptop business and you want to ship around your laptops, maybe you don't want to use UPS because they have a special deal worked out with Toshiba. And so Toshiba's going to get a break by working with UPS. And if you're somebody else, if you're Dell or so on, maybe you want to use a different group for that. He also talks about what's known as informing, which is kind of the individual's ability to manage the supply chain of information that you use to educate yourself and inform yourself about what's actually taking place in the world. Probably the best example of this, of course, these days is Wikipedia, which is just a veritable treasure trove of information about all kinds of things that you may not even have known would have been documented any place. I use it for many, many different things, ranging from doing research and trying to figure out what new technologies are coming along and how they work, to looking for information for patents and other kinds of intellectual property concerns. There's always the danger, of course, that by using these kinds of resources, people can find out perhaps a little too much about you. And one of the things that we're often encouraging our students more and more, especially when they come in as freshmen, these days they probably have even this experience when they're in high school, but you can get yourself into trouble by putting things up on the web that seem rather funny and frivolous at the time, but come back to bite you in 15 or 20 years when you're running for Congress or something. And there's all kinds of pictures of you at the keg party at Kappa Alpha, and you really wish those things hadn't been preserved for eternity on the web. So it's really interesting to see the explosion of things like social networking technologies and how those things are being used for all kinds of purposes, both good and bad. He also talks about something called the steroids, which are basically all the little gizmos that we have. Obviously, the very smallest gizmos like word processor, like microprocessors and voice over IP and so on, teleconferencing, video conferencing, cell phones, smartphones, all this kind of stuff, which are all used to make us either heavily consumed with attention deficit disorder, which is really probably the reality here, or it allows us to be much better connected to people we're trying to work with and more productive. Surprisingly enough, and I've seen this when I travel around the world, particularly in Asia, although to some extent in Europe as well, the U.S. is actually surprisingly far behind in the cool gadgets and gizmos race, which of course reminds me of the classic Dr. Strangelove, the mineshaft gap. We have a cool gadgets gap. In fact, if you take a look around, there's just some amazing things coming out. If you remember Dick Tracy and his two-way wristwatch and so on, that the Japanese have stuff pretty much like that. And it's really remarkable. Take a look sometime on the Motorola website and look at the phones that they sell in the United States and what capabilities they have, and look at the phones they sell in Asia and Europe and the capabilities that they have. And you'll be surprised to find that the cell phone technology is actually far superior outside of the U.S. for some reason. At the heart of these steroids, one reason why that's the case, by the way, is because, especially in places like Japan, it's so much easier to have seamless mobility every inch of the country because it's so much smaller. And they were a little smarter about coming up with a single set of protocols that are used, so you don't have quite as many different variants of things. So if you have a computer or a phone, you can be going pretty much anywhere. You can be on a train, in your car, at your home, in your office, and you can have a telephone call, you can keep the same network connection going, and that's something we just can't do in the United States because there's so much more geography to cover and so much more competition in terms of different approaches, different standards. At the heart of this stuff, of course, are technologies for distributed real-time and embedded systems, and I won't go into that right now because it's a bit outside the scope of the talk, but we do a lot of work on those types of topics here at Vanderbilt, and you might want to take a look at some of the resources we have here to find out more about what's going on. So those were basically the 10 forces that flatten the world and have leveled the playing field. What Friedman, of course, points out is this is not just about technology. It's a lot more than just providing the means to change the way in which people do information technology. It's really about changing the practices and the processes and the global culture. So technology is one piece, but there are two other parts that are important. And he calls this the triple convergence that's enabled the rapid evolution. Think about it. It's only really been just a little bit more than 10 years since we had things like Netscape and the World Wide Web. And nowadays, they're, in many people's lives at least, they're pretty much indispensable. And it's amazing how much information you get from those kinds of things. So it's technology, of course, but it's also trying to get business processes to learn to use the technology effectively. And that takes a long time. I remember many years ago, I was doing some work at Motorola. And this was around the time that the cell phones were first coming out. They were kind of, you know, we were kind of replacing our reliance on landline phones with wireless mobile phones. And I remember the resistance that Motorola, many people in Motorola had in those days, to try to come up with intelligent phones. For example, I remember talking to one guy there who said, he was a very senior person in the technology area, and he said, why should we put a directory, like a, you know, a phone book of names and phone numbers, onto a cell phone when people who use their desk phone don't expect to find a directory on their phone? They have a directory next to them, and they use that when they want to call. Why do we need to do this? And it was interesting, because it wasn't about just having the technical ability, it had to do about changing the mentality of what people are using these devices for. Well, of course, they learned from that experience, and as the company was beaten to the punch by people like Ericsson and Nokia, they got a lot smarter, and nowadays they have many interesting and good offerings in that space. In fact, their big buzzword is seamless mobility, and they talk about the third screen. So the three screens in your life are your TV, and your desktop or laptop is your second screen, and your smartphone is your third screen. And people perceive that that one probably becomes the most important one because it's the most mobile and portable. But trying to get people to understand supply chain management, trying to get them to understand outsourcing and open source and offshoring, that takes a long time. And it's only been in the last 5 years or so that's really taken off. The third piece of the puzzle, of course, and this is where the 11-9-89 fall of the Berlin Wall comes in, is the globalization of the workforce. And the fact that nowadays, several billion people who used to be trapped behind iron curtains and firewalls are now in a much more effective position to compete. And that has all kinds of interesting consequences on us. Well, that starts to beg some interesting questions. There's a potential for reading Friedman's book and getting rather depressed and saying to yourself, the sky is falling, we'll never compete, we're not going to be able to be in a position to maintain our lifestyle and so on, so we'll just give up. But I don't think that's really his point. I think that we have a lot to learn that goes beyond that. What I'd like to do in the remaining part of the talk is talk about some of the ways to succeed in a flat world, and also about some of the consequences on things like surviving in the information technology world and vortex that we live in these days. So first of all, how do you succeed in a flat world? Well, according to Friedman, there's four ways to do it. The first way is to become an untouchable. Well, actually, the main way is to become an untouchable, and there are four different ways to become untouchable. The first way is to be a worker who is special, right? So Michael Jordan, he's a special worker. Kind of hard to replace him. Bill Gates, he's pretty special. People will eventually replace him, but he certainly has been extremely influential at Microsoft for over 25 years. Some people we'd like to replace and just don't seem to be able to get rid of them. Well, we'll get rid of them for a short 45-day stint here, but they'll be back, don't worry. There's also workers who are specialized. So people, certain kinds of lawyers, right? It's kind of hard to get rid of some of the people like Johnny Cochran comes to mind, the guy who defended Michael Jackson comes to mind. Accountants, brain surgeons, certain kinds of people who build software, these are people who have very special skills, and you can't just replace them with someone who's a low-cost commodity without losing something very important. I should note, of course, by the way, that not all of these professions may be as untouchable as we might think. One of the phenomena that's taking place these days is because the cost of medicine and healthcare in the U.S. is becoming so extraordinarily outlandish, a lot of people these days are opting to go to places like India for surgery. And they can get very, very skilled doctors at a fraction of the cost. And even with the cost of the airplane ride and the lodging and so on, it's still, in many cases, so I hear, much more cost-effective a lot of times. But I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon in the large. There are also workers, of course, who are anchored. It's pretty hard to outsource your barber. It's hard to outsource your plumber, your electrician, your nurses and doctors. Those are probably in pretty good positions for a long time. Although in some places people are being outsourced, or certain activities of those jobs are being outsourced. For example, a lot of people who do stuff like searching in patent databases to try to find information about claims, a lot of that work is now being outsourced to people in India who can drudge through reams and reams and reams of documents and try to find things that match, and they're very well educated, many educated here, but the costs are much lower. I think the fourth and final category, which is really the takeaway point from this message that I'd like to share with you about education, is that the untouchables are workers who become really adaptable, which means lifelong learning, which means that the final exam on the final day of the final class before graduation is not when you switch your brain off and decide, that's it, my brain is full, and I'm not going to learn anything new. And this is something, of course, in the information technology world that you see all the time. If you continue to live out of a rag bag collection of old ideas and old technologies and old products and languages and systems and so on, you're very quickly overtaken, and it's hard to stay competitive for very long in those environments. So you have to continue to be able to acquire new skills and expertise. The last part of the talk, I'd like to kind of discuss how this is affecting my field, computer science. Computer science is one of these interesting fields that has gone through a number of boom and busts. If you take a look over the last, 35 years or so, from the early 70s till the last couple of years, this is a chart of enrollments during that time in computer science for both males and females, and then combined. And you see some interesting things. It kind of looks like a camel in some ways. And what you see is the following. Around the 1980s, people believed that you would not have a job in the future if you were not a computer science major. There was a huge spike in enrollment around that time. I call this fear motivation. Then, the middle 90s through the early 2000s, people thought if you were a computer science major, you'd end up with a Maserati signing bonus when you went to work for a company in Silicon Valley. I call that greed motivation. Of course, the truth is probably somewhere in between. We discovered we didn't all have to be computer science majors to be able to use computers. And once people figured that out, they thought, well, I'd like to get another 20 hours of sleep a week, so maybe I don't have to major in computer science. I can just become a user of Microsoft Word and Excel. And so we saw things kind of drop back to a more common level. And then here, of course, people realized that, darn, it turns out that I'm not going to get a Maserati signing bonus, and I had to work pretty hard in order to get there, and so I'd rather be a biomedical major or something like that. And so as a result, there's been a drop-off. In some sense, this is probably good. During the boom times, people were majors, perhaps for the wrong reasons. They were perhaps majors because their parents said, or they decided, this is how I'm going to get wealthy, and it was kind of a get-rich-quick scheme. They wanted people to show them the money, in the words of Jerry Maguire. And that isn't always necessarily the best reason to choose your major in life. We're lucky in the United States. You can make decisions many different times in your life and usually find a way to recover from them. You may go to school. I know many people, when I went to college, thought that they were going to be pre-med, and they perpetuated that belief until their first organic chemistry test. And then they all decided that maybe being a history major wasn't so bad after all. But the great thing about the United States is you can change your mind many times through your career, and if you're willing to work hard, you'll find a way to be able to succeed. I was actually a sociology major in college at William & Mary, where the Queen spoke recently. You may have seen that. I got my first master's degree in sociology, and then along the way I realized that it was a wonderful subject and I liked it very much, but it certainly was not going to pay the rent very well, so I switched over to computer science. In most other countries in the world, those kinds of changes are unheard of. You get tracked early on in your life. You're one of you're either the intellectual class, or you're the worker technology class, or you're the laborer class. And once you're slotted, you can't change very easily. But we can change those kinds of things. And so it's really a good thing that people are able to be adaptive. But one of the problems that's happening today is people start to think that we don't have a future in this field because of the outsourcing and so on. The enrollments are falling off quite a bit. And the reason for that is people think that there's not going to be any jobs in these fields in the future. Well, what's interesting is to actually take a look around and see what kinds of jobs will be the growth jobs, the hot job prospects over the next decade or so, and see how many of those are crucially related to experience in information technology. For example, out of the top 10 jobs, this is from the top 10 fastest growing occupations between 2002 and 2012 by Department of Commerce. Many of them either involve developing computer technologies, networking and software engineering and computer engineering and so on, or being very facile users of these technologies. So medical assistants, physician assistants, medical record and health information technology technicians, these are all people who have to work very intimately with computers. I remember when my wife gave birth about 6 months ago, one of the local hospitals, and how electronic everything is now. When they come to bring you your baby, they check a little tag he has, and they check a little tag you have, and make sure they're not giving you the wrong kid. When they come to bring you the medicine, they do the same thing. It's just amazing how much better and electronically organized it is. And a lot of these jobs are not jobs that are easily outsourced. I was commissioned to work with Carnegie Mellon a year and a half ago on a study of the future of software engineering technology. And we produced a report which talks about many of the interesting growth areas in the field. And a lot of these areas are in aerospace and defense and homeland security. And these are not jobs you can easily outsource because of various classification and so-called ITAR restrictions on who can have access to sensitive information kinds of things. And there's lots of those kinds of things that are out there, and people need to realize they're not going away anytime soon. In fact, in some cases, they're growth industries. So the point to really learn from this is that people who are well-educated in hard disciplines, the ones where you have to stay up late at night in college and work diligently, and even if you work hard, sometimes you still have a hard time getting straight A's, those people are going to have an edge. Here's another set of results from employment and wages for all occupations in this time frame. And you can see here, again, that computers and people in these fields are doing quite well. And in fact, really only the management people and the lawyers are doing better in an average way. The problem, of course, is the fear of outsourcing is what is preventing or discouraging people from getting involved in these fields. And this is a very, very serious problem. And I think if we don't do something about it, and mind you, I don't have all the answers of what we need to do about this, but we need to start doing something about this, we're really going to fall behind. And it's already happening. If you look at the number of PhDs and master students that we are producing every year in the U.S., keep in mind, a lot of these people are not U.S. citizens who are producing. It is paling in comparison to the number being produced in India and China. And this is in all sciences and engineering disciplines. And it's also interesting to note that in places like China, not that I want to move to China anytime soon and live there, but it's remarkable the number of people in that country's political system who have engineering backgrounds. Almost unheard of, engineering or science backgrounds. Almost unheard of in the U.S. political system, with very few exceptions, a couple of whom were from Tennessee and Vanderbilt, for that matter. But it's the fear of this, is your job next, will we be hurt, and so on, that's keeping people from going to these disciplines. And of course, eventually this becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and that's the danger. For those of you who have watched the movie The Lord of the Rings by Peter Jackson, and of course from the Tolkien books, there's a great metaphor, I think, there that helps to tell the point. In the movie, in the book, there's a character named Denethor, who's the steward of Gondor. And he has this magical seeing stone he spends his time looking into. And the seeing stone, which he doesn't quite understand, is being controlled by the evil Lord Sauron. And Sauron is giving him information of what will happen in the future. Except that information is incomplete. And he spends all of his time watching in this thing, gazing into his crystal ball, seeing incomplete fragments of what's going on, until it drives him nuts and he kills himself because he can't deal with the information he's getting. Well, of course, it doesn't really turn out to be the truth, because the truth was something different. And oftentimes I feel that the information that we get from our media is much the same. So if you're not careful, if you just watch and read certain selected areas of media, you can get a very different impression about what's really happening. As an example, to make this more concrete, the students that we have here at Vanderbilt who have IT backgrounds and engineering backgrounds have no trouble getting very good jobs. They get snapped up right away. In fact, we have waiting lists of employers around town, in the region, and around the country and the world who love to snap up our graduates quickly. So there's no problems there. In fact, if you also look about where the jobs are going to be, again, it's remarkable how many will be in the professional IT occupations. And there are various reasons for this. But what's interesting is if you look at the enrollments, disciplines like biomedical engineering have maybe 4 to 5 times the number of students now. Even though if you actually look at the number of jobs in those areas, they're much, much lower. So there's some PR issues to be dealt with and some perception to try to address. So I think with that, I will go ahead and wrap up, and I'd be happy to take questions or chat if you have anything you'd like to say. I think the point of all this stuff is that globalization, which is effectively the leveling of the playing field around the world, is happening whether we know it or whether we like it. And really the question is, what are we, and really we ultimately comes down to us as individuals, going to do about that? I think that there's a good little poem that Friedman quotes in his book, and I'll read it to you. It says, "Every morning in Africa, a gazelle wakes up. It knows it must run faster than the fastest lion, or it will be killed. Every morning a lion wakes up, it knows it must outrun the slowest gazelle, or it will starve to death. It doesn't matter whether you're a lion or a gazelle. When the sun comes up, you better start running. I think that's a good metaphor for the end of the talk. So thank you very much. If people are interested, there's actually a somewhat longer set of slides. I commented some things out in the interest of time and without getting down too far a rat hole of geek talk. But if you want to see the whole presentation, it's available on my website. Any questions about any of the topics I've discussed? Yes, sir.
I have a tangential question.
Sure.
What's going to happen to, where is Microsoft in its evolution? And will web-based software supplant conventional software?
That's a great question. So Microsoft has, I would say it's in its, it's kind of its, if you're familiar with Geoffrey Moore's Crossing the Chasm, it's in its sort of late mainstream phase. Microsoft, of course, has done an amazing job with what they do well. So they've done a great job with their operating system, Windows, and their suite of Office productivity tools, Microsoft Word, PowerPoint, like we're seeing here, Excel, and so on. But unfortunately, those are their major cash cow products. And they've tried for quite some time now to diversify with limited success. For example, they tried to do MSN, the networking portal type thing, like Yahoo and Google. Has nowhere near the amount of subscribers as some of the other portals. They've also tried to expand into other areas like entertainment, and they've done reasonably well with the Xbox, but it's not anywhere near the cash cow that Windows and the Office products are. Now, to give them credit, they've also done a pretty good job of being able to absorb new technology. So when the web came along, they did a wonderful job of kind of turning on a dime very quickly and webifying most of their applications, which has really enabled them to keep doing a good job. But there are a couple of forces that are really working against their future meteoric growth. So I think I would, if I was a stock analyst, I would say, you know, they're a good investment if you want to buy and hold, but they're not going to go up by 30 to 40% per year. They're going to generate a lot of revenue off of their existing product lines. So I think they're sort of in a late mature stage. And I think that's probably something that's borne out by the stock price and things. The problem that they're running into it at many levels is that so many people there are fully vested that new employees coming in, because the stock isn't going up very quickly, don't have the same incentives that the ones who were there 15 years ago have. And so the people who are looking for the new gold rush are going to places like Google. And this is especially true overseas. So if you look at where do people want to work, if they are smart people, they want to go to Google. Google is becoming kind of the new Bell Labs, if you will. Their goal is to hire really smart people, or the new Xerox PARC. And they hire really smart people, they have a core line of business, and they really try to push for creative people, many of whom may or may not even be technologists in the classic sense. They just want, you know, really smart people. And they call them googly people. They're looking for googly people. A bunch of Google people, recruiters, came here the other day, so I talked with them about this. So I think that Microsoft will continue to do well with the web, but the whole model is changing from a product-centric model to a service-centric model. And people increasingly want to be able to get very customized software experiences that they can control through their browser. And so perhaps the day of the rich client, which is what always Microsoft has been, the rich client, has been supplanted by the adaptive client. So you need some kind of interface to be able to download applets and other things and other web, so-called Web 2.0 technologies to your interface to the world. But those things don't necessarily have to be stuff that you buy and put into your computer's disk drive and download from a CD. So I think the real competition is going to be over the web-enabled web services stuff, and that really is potentially a new group of competitors, and Google being one of the main ones. You can see, if you've been following this in the last week or so, some of the people who compete with Google, like Yahoo, are looking to join forces with Microsoft. That may or may not actually happen, but it's an example of how concerned those companies are. And of course, the other big thing is the open source threat from Linux. Linux has continued to be very successful, especially on the server side. And those will continue to be like that, I think. Yes, sir?
Not from the vantage point of commerce or technology, but from the vantage point of community and social structures, is there any concern on the part of Friedman about traditional communal sort of structures and family structures and how this flattening process will affect those? or is it sort of you just, you know, like Putnam's bowling alone and this kind of thing, or is it you just kind of don't worry about that anymore and you just jump on board altogether with it?
Well, I have to say that Friedman is most of his book is extremely enthusiastic about technology and globalization. He's writing a book that is basically a set of talking points for someone who wants to make the case for globalization being a good thing. He does have a few things, which I didn't actually put in my presentation originally, but I'll just say them quickly, and they touch on a little bit of what you're saying here. Is a flat world actually inevitable or desirable? And his point in the book is that, of course, not everybody benefits in a flat world, right? People who are traditional market leaders, like maybe Microsoft, they aren't necessarily so sure this is a good thing, right? The poor and disenfranchised, they necessarily don't always like this either, although that's, again, a very subtle issue, and it's not as simple and black and white as, you know, evil colonialists and imperialists coming along and exploiting these lands. It's a lot more subtle than that. Groups with other economic models. Not everybody in the world wants to be totally free market capital. For example, the Norwegians come to mind, right? They have a very interesting model there where they're taking the money that they get from their oil, North Sea oil, and they have this fund that they invest. They're like the world's biggest investor right now. And they invest their money in stocks or companies they believe are doing good things for the world. I think I would also put here is not everybody benefits. People who have a more, I will say traditional, but conventional view of social environments. Very, very different, right? Most people's relationship, if you get into the cyber world, increasingly you are connected to people all around the world who you never physically meet or rarely physically meet, and yet you engage in activity with them all day long, often at the expense of other people who are perhaps more immediate to you, but who don't necessarily have your same interests or you may find to be less interesting or whatever. So there's certainly pros and cons to that, right? I mean, in some sense, personally, I find myself always amazed at the extent to which I can interact with people from around the world. And even though I only see them, if ever, occasionally, I can still carry out many, many years of interesting interactions. But you don't want to get so wrapped up in that that you lose sight of the people here and there, you know, here and now. Something else he mentions also along here, which I'll just say quickly because I think it's worth saying, globalization is not necessarily an inexorable process that won't stop, mostly because there's limits that you run up against. Like, you know, will globalization 3.0 lead to energy crisis 2.0, right? Energy crisis 1.0 would probably have been in 1973 or so. And now we're kind of back in that same mode. The other problem, of course, is that if other countries like China and India get a lot more industrialized, that's good at one level, but it also means they're going to consume a lot more resources. And if they're not renewable, then we have issues there. And they're also probably going to, unless we can figure out ways to burn off use those resources effectively, they're also going to create a lot of pollution. So the social issues, the economic issues, the political issues, the environmental issues, these are all things that are ultimately making limitations on this. And other parts of the world don't necessarily always opt into exactly the same way we do it here. Europe is probably a classic example of that. They at least try to, in many countries, to have more of a balance between sort of social meetings, broader social needs, and meeting the needs of business. And those are good and bad things. I'm always amazed when I go to Europe and many of my friends there work for companies where they, by law, cannot be in the office more than 35 hours a week. So Germany and France are pretty much like that. And you have to get special exemptions if you work longer. Of course, what everybody does now that you can do telecommuting is you go home and you work from home. But it's very, very hard to be productive and competitive working 35 hours a week in a science and engineering field, especially when there are people who are those gazelles we were talking about before who are willing to run a lot faster and a lot longer for a lot less. And it will be interesting to see how long that process continues. So what I thought was interesting about the Friedman book was not that he was, you know, I don't necessarily believe all the great things he says about globalization, but he makes you think about why the world is changing in the way that it is. And then you can draw your own conclusions as to whether it's good or bad, or both. Yes, sir?
You mentioned the concern of the number of American citizens getting graduate, postgraduate degrees compared to India and China. How much of that do you think is because of the economic impact of getting that higher level degree? And is that the same issue that they have with the Indian getting a degree in India or China?
That's a very good point. I'll certainly say in India, when people grow up and they want to get ahead, they become engineers. That's just the way it's done. And or maybe doctors, but engineers for sure is sort of the surefire way of moving ahead. and the really smart ones go to IIT, and then they come here and they get master's degrees or PhDs. The other marginally smart ones go to work locally and do very well. But the problem that I was just alluding to 30 minutes ago or so is that people are discovering now, because there's so many more opportunities, they don't have to work quite as hard, and they can still get a good job. So during the run-up to the dot-com boom, we had a really hard time at Washington University trying to keep our students in master's programs and PhD programs, because they could go off to Silicon Valley and get that Maserati signing bonus. I think what's going to happen in the United States, and we've already seen this happening with other disciplines, so if you want to get a good job with a biology degree or a good job with a chemistry degree, you probably need to get an advanced degree, right? If you have a biology degree and you go to work, you're going to be washing test tubes. If you have a master's degree, you're going to be helping a professor with experiments. If you have a PhD, you'll be doing the experiments. So if you want to do something more interesting, you have to get a higher level degree. In computing, for a long time, back in the good old days, you could get a bachelor's degree and go out and get a great job. I think you can still do that. The danger is that what you're doing may not be the most interesting thing. And when times get tough and you want to outsource stuff, you're going to outsource the more, I won't say menial is the wrong term, but the jobs that are for the lower level people than you will for the people who are the architects, the people who are the real experienced experts. So I think what's happening is, over time, I would think, that people will often need to get advanced degrees to be doing the good jobs. You can still always get a job doing system administration work or payroll accounting programming or something like that. But a lot of those are the jobs are also going to be ones that will be outsourced as quickly as they can. They're probably, honestly, jobs that should be automated. Many things that really shouldn't be done by people. Just as an analogy, there's a great History Channel show I saw one time about the fall of the Peru Empire. And one of the problems was, at one point they had Cortez or someone, they had him trapped in a city, and there were maybe 20 of him and his soldiers and 300,000 people who were trying to kill them. And they couldn't sustain the siege very long because all those people had to return back home to grow the crops or the whole civilization would starve. And that was because the whole civilization was based on manual agriculture. Well, look what happens now. You have maybe 1% of the population in the U.S. growing all the food and everybody else eats it. So the reason that works is because of automation and technology. And I think what will happen over time is we will perhaps have less people doing the technology, but hopefully they'll be doing more interesting jobs, and because they'll be more automated, they'll be able to work at higher level tools. But it's a very interesting question. Yes, ma'am.
Has there been any slowing or reversal of the trend towards outsourcing software to India, insofar as the reality of the time difference between user community, developers, and actual coders, that disconnect is pretty big, and actually doing it is a lot more difficult than might be at first perceived?
I agree. There certainly has been many examples of failures of outsourcing. But let me give you, I'll give you two answers. I'll first give you my somewhat cynical answer, and then I'll give you another answer. I think in reality, here's what's happening. People are accustomed to software projects failing. And so when you have to pay high-paid workers a lot for the project to fail, it's very disconcerting. When you pay low-cost people and the project fails, you don't feel so bad. And since it's probably going to fail anyway, you can do it 5 times, and maybe eventually it'll work. So part of that's what's happening. That's a somewhat cynical answer. I think in more reality, here's what's happening. Major companies like Motorola, IBM, Cisco are not outsourcing anymore. They're offshoring. They have development groups over in Bangalore and other places in India that are Motorola India. And those people are extremely talented. Many of them went to school here, except they just want to go back and work at home or work back in their country. And so they're not really outsourcing so much anymore. They're doing the development there. And in fact, one of the real dangers we face as a country is that we don't even if we wanted to go back and do a lot of this work, there's nobody left who even understands how it works, because we've so much moved that expertise over there. And so what I see the US doing right now, our rationalization is, well, that's okay. We'll do the systems engineering. We'll do the usability part. We'll understand what the customers want. We'll do that part. We'll do the integration, and we'll outsource the kind of the menial programming jobs in these other places, and we'll come back and we'll do the high margin things. Well, the problem is that works as long as we're the major market. But as India and China become the major market and consumers of these technologies, they're not necessarily going to want or need US systems engineers and architects and integrators to put it back together. They're going to want India or Chinese or Pakistani or whoever, experts to do that. So that's the part where the offshoring and outsourcing gets tricky, because you lose so much of that expertise that even if you wanted to take it back, you'd have a hard time doing it. This is also affecting us in some other interesting ways in the defense world. I mentioned before about this whole issue of not being able to outsource a lot of those jobs. Well, the basic problem that we're running into is that unlike most of the other IT occupations like telecom, medicine, and so on, where you can get skilled foreign-born labor educated in the United States to come and do the work for you, you can't really do that for the defense and homeland security types of things. And because we're no longer producing enough good engineers and software developers, even the places where there's still lots of opportunities, like the defense world, don't have enough good people who want to go into those fields. So they're having a hard time competing because they can't afford to take advantage of the outsourcing of the things to people who come and live here, right? Which is what most of the other IT companies are doing when they're still working here. It's a very tricky and very subtle thing. My biggest fear is that because this stuff is somewhat esoteric, unlike healthcare, where people can really understand, everybody knows what healthcare is, because things like information technology are very abstract and obscure, it's very hard to explain to policymakers and politicians the importance of maintaining a presence in these areas. You can do it in a few things like cryptography or supercomputers and so on, but in terms of just the base of education and experience in this stuff, it's very hard to get anybody excited about trying to redress the brain drain that's taking place in this area. So that's a concern as well. Okay, great. Again, thank you guys very much for coming, and enjoy the rest of the commencement. Let me just turn this off.
Hey, one quick thing on this.
Yeah.
Do you remember Bugwadi's?